Suspense writer Hallie Efron knows from difficult mothers.
If anyone was responsible for the Efron girls being writers, it's my mother. I mean, she was a writer. She loved books. She loved poetry. She gave us wonderful books. And then she had this dark side. So by the time she died, you know, you get worn out. Your feelings are so complicated. You're relieved as much as you're grieving. And that's really what I wanted to write about, was that really complicated thing that happens when you have a person like that in your life.
Her newest page-turner is There Was an Old Woman. Its protagonists are the daughter of a difficult mother and her mother's 90-year-old neighbor, who's the most delightful sleuth since Miss Marple. And then Lionel Shriver delves into the loyalties that can divide families.
Well, it is a story about conflict of loyalties, and of a sort that I think a lot of us end up encountering at one time or another. You have more than one family once you grow up and get married. So sometimes your loyalty to your old family and your new family come into conflict. I think it's also quite common for spouses to be a little jealous of the kind of intimacy that siblings enjoy. They leave you out.
And trouble brews when, in Shriver's new novel, Big Brother, her main character's morbidly obese brother comes to visit and she feels compelled to get him to lose weight. Lionel Shriver lost her own brother to obesity. Her novel, Big Brother, explores the issues of power struggles in families, our society's obsession with food, and the obesity epidemic, all deftly drawn with Shriver's dry wit. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riana. When we think of the generic mystery novel, what comes to mind is a hard-boiled detective, usually male, sexy, and physically powerful. Mina Yetner couldn't be further from that stereotype. One of the two protagonists in Hallie Efron's new novel, There Was an Old Woman, Yetner is 90, nearly blind without her glasses, and fearing that she might be losing her mind when strange things begin to happen around her house. The mystery deepens when her next-door neighbor Sandra is hospitalized in a coma, and the neighbor's daughter Evie comes knocking for some answers. Evie is a museum curator about to mount the biggest exhibition of her young career. The last thing she needs is to be dealing with her mother, whose rampant alcoholism Evie blames for landing her in the hospital in the first place. But is her mother's drinking really the cause? Nefarious forces are circling around Sandra and Mimi's neighborhood, rapacious real estate interests seeking to develop the area. Old residents like Mimi and Sandra are just in the way. The plot is a marvelous vehicle for Hallie Efron to explore two themes, our society's attitude toward the old, especially old women, and the impact of uncontrolled development on communities and environments that are hanging on by a thread. Hallie Efron is the author of numerous works of suspense, including Never Tell a Lie, which we spoke to her about in 2009, and Come and Find Me. She's also co-author of the Dr. Peter Zack Mystery Series and a how-to book, Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel. There Was an Old Woman was published by William Morrow in April 2013.
Well, Hallie Efron, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I just loved this book, There Was an Old Woman, and there are several old women in this book. I especially loved Mina Yetner, who is one of the main characters and one of the sleuths in the story.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about her.
I love Mina, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's 91 years old, and she's sharp. And, you know, I know a lot of women like that. 90 is old, but more and more, it's, you know, people are getting around and taking care of themselves and being perfectly sharp and reading and staying current on events. And she really helps the younger character in this book, a 30-something, figure out what's going on with her mother. And so she's terrified, though, of losing her mind, which we all are as we get older.
So, as you mentioned, there is a younger character. The book actually opens with Sandra Ferrante saying something to Mina. That's her neighbor, Sandra Ferrante, saying something to Mina as Sandra is being wheeled into an ambulance. Tell us what's going on at that moment.
Well, Sandra has been has collapsed in her house. She's called the police, managed to do that. They've come to take her out. Sandra is an alcoholic. She's up and she's down, and over time, you know, she's had these episodes where she has to go to the hospital and get dried out. And so Mina's her neighbor. She knows what's going on, more or less. But this time, Sandra seems worse. And when she calls her over as she's getting put into the ambulance, she says, "Don't let him in until I'm gone." And she begs her to call Ginger, who's one of Sandra's daughters, and gives her the phone number. So that's kind of the first gotcha in the book. That's the first moment I hope that the reader will feel all is not copacetic here.
Tell us where they are. This is a very particular community in New York.
It is. I started writing this book with a vision of a very old woman sitting on her back porch looking across a salt marsh and far in the distance, the Manhattan skyline. And I didn't know if such a place existed, so I asked a friend of mine who scouts locations in New York for movie companies, and he sent me back GPS coordinates. And so I plugged them into Google and, you know, pulled the little man over and looked around to see what it was. And it's a neighborhood in Classen Point in the Bronx, around where the East River dumps out into the Long Island Sound. The bridge connects Queens to the Bronx there. And there really is a marsh. There really is this amazing view. And there really is this very idiosyncratic neighborhood of narrow little houses lined up along the water where, at the turn of the century, there were once tent platforms. And people from Queens, you know, summer-weary residents, would take the ferry across and rent these tents and stay for weeks at a time in the summer, and then the little platforms were turned into houses. So it's very much off any kind of planning grid. The roads are much narrower, the houses are narrower than anyone would allow them to be. But for some reason, Robert Moses never tore down the neighborhood, never filled in the marsh, and here it still is today. Now, I used the physicality of the neighborhood, but not the people. This really isn't about the people who actually live there. I made up a whole community. I made up a general store. I made up a lot of things about this particular place, but I used its history because it really had this great amusement park there, which becomes important in the story. It really does have a view of the Empire State Building. It really is geographically the way I describe it.
And what's the name of the community?
I call it Higgs Point, and that's because the real historical figure who owned all those tent platforms and all the farmland surrounding it was named Thomas Higgs in the history books.
Wow.
So I called it Higgs Point. But in fact, those are what are called the Harding Park bungalows, and it's in Classen Point.
And you actually had a vision of this.
Yeah. You know, I'm very visual when I write. I see cinematically through my character's eyes as I move them down the street. And I often say, you know, I really write not so much settings as neighborhoods and houses. And they're very vibrant to me, and I just try to get them down on the page. And I also try to draw them so that I can remember, you know, the details of, you know, which way is, what's on the left, what's on the right, what's across the street. And if I'm standing here, what can I see, that kind of thing.
Well, let's get a little bit more into the story. Evie Ferrante and her sister Ginger are the daughters of Sandra. They're alerted when her mom is taken to the hospital. It maybe takes them a little while to get this message about not letting some mysterious guy into the house until after their mother is, quote, gone, unquote. Tell us about Evie and Ginger and the relationship between them.
Well, Ginger is the one who always comes home to take care of Mom. Ginger is the good daughter. She's got kids. She's got a husband. She lives, I think I put her out in Connecticut. She's getting her graduate degree. She's a very busy woman, and yet she's the one who comes home because Evie lives in Brooklyn. She has this high-powered job, and Ginger's had it. She says, not this time. This time you're going. And I don't care that you have your first solo-curated show at the Historical Society Museum. I've had it. It's your turn. And so Evie has to step up to the plate, and she knows she should. The sisters are close, and it is time that she shouldered some of the burden. And so she does, only this time it's much worse. She assumes it's like every other time, because her mother is always hitting rock bottom and bouncing, only this time she's not going to bounce.
I lost my mother last year, and I spent the last few years of her life being the good daughter and taking care of her. I was so struck by the verisimilitude with which you paint this aspect of the relationship between the sisters and their mother and their thoughts about caretaking and how they confront their mother's illness and her disability. Is this something you've experienced as well?
Yeah. My mother was an alcoholic. And died at 56 when I was 22 years old. Mm. And, you know, I think my older sisters more than me, and of course my father was around, more shouldered the burden. But, you know, I've lived through what it's like to lose someone who has been very difficult, both for herself and for everyone around her, and yet who, in her own way, was... I mean, if anyone was responsible for the Efren girls being writers, it's my mother. I mean, she was a writer. She loved books. She loved poetry. She gave us wonderful books. And then she had this dark side. By the time she died, you know, you get worn out. Your feelings are so complicated. You're relieved as much as you're grieving. And that's really what I wanted to write about, was that really complicated thing that happens when you have a person like that in your life, who's kind of a maelstrom, kind of a sucks all the energy towards herself at different points in your life, and you're just exhausted by the time they die.
Yeah. Now, you're the sister of Nora Ephron, is that right?
I am, yeah. I'm the third, so it's Nora, Delia, me, and then Amy.
And are they all writers?
All writers, all best-selling writers. I got with the program very late. They were all well-published, extremely well-published in Nora's case, by the time I started writing. And I always said I wasn't a writer. That was my way of rebelling. I was a teacher. How do you like that? Rebelling by saying I'm a teacher, right? You know.
So what changed? What got you into it?
I don't know exactly. I mean, I think I got old enough that I stopped worrying about being compared to them. I got old enough that I wasn't worried about failing so much as worried that if I didn't try, I'd never know if I could. And I also came to a point in my life where I had, the kids were stable and pretty much out there, and I had the time to... I had a room in the house. I do think you need a room to write in. So I took over their playroom because they no longer needed a place for their blocks. And all of those things sort of came together with me, and I could take a little risk financially because we'd been saving money for so many years. So many reasons. My husband was very encouraging. And I just, you know, started writing. First things I wrote were essays. I took a class in essay writing. I thought, ooh, I have opinions. How hard can this be? It's not easy.
It is not easy.
But, no. But I did sell one of the first pieces I wrote to National Public Radio. And I always say to aspiring writers, you know, I was lucky. I got some affirmation in the first year. And it's very tough because it's a very steep incline learning to write. And it takes a long time, and there's a lot of rejection along the way. And you're lucky if, as I was, you get somebody pays you for something. Something about getting paid for your writing that just takes it to a different level. You start to take yourself seriously.
Well, I'm so glad you did get that early success and persisted. We're talking with Hallie Efron about her newest novel, There Was an Old Woman. And let's get back to that novel because it's just a terrific read. You mentioned before that the community, Hicks Point, that you write about in the book is based on a real community. You have another twist to the story, which is also based on a real event, one that I had no idea ever happened until I read your book, and that is that on July 28, 1945, there was a collision between a plane and the Empire State Building. Mm-hmm. And this figures in your story. Why did you bring that real event into your story, and what role does it play?
Isn't it amazing that so few people know about that? Because you would have thought in the wake of 9/11, people would have remembered the last time a plane hit a skyscraper. But it kind of got buried in history, in part because the U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima only a few days later. So it kind of got buried in other news. But Mina grows up in this neighborhood. She's a little girl. She watches each of the skyscrapers go up. And she gets her first job at the Empire State Building. And she would have been working there when the plane crashed. And Evie is working on an exhibit of, it's called Seared in Memory at the Historical Society, and she's highlighting four or five big fires, and one of them is the fire in the aftermath of the plane collision. So I wanted to use that story because it's a piece of Mina's life, and it's a piece of what Evie is working on. And all of a sudden she realizes her neighbor is the last survivor, the last person who was up there in the 70th floor or 75th floor. And I won't tell you, she has another secret. I don't want to spoil for the reader. Mina has another secret about that fire. But, you know, before I found that fire, I thought I was going to write another plot that involved the fire at the Trade Towers. And I had this great idea about a man who would be in the list of victims, and when Evie has to check the victims, she realizes he was fired a week before the terrorist attack, and so how could he have been in the building? Mm-hmm. And what she discovers is he was there. He went into intending to kill his coworkers and ended up saving them. Well, I thought, you know, cool, great plot, but, you know, I took a trip to the museum, the 9/11 museum, and it took me 3 minutes to realize I couldn't possibly put that in the book. It was just so trivializing what is such a huge, still, you know, aching wound. I just threw out about 50 pages and said, the heck with this, and found this. And Google is the way I found the Empire State Building fire. I had no idea about it. And there it was in these great pictures that a New York Times reporter took, and the wonderful story about what happened to the engines. Can I tell that story?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah. The plane, a B-25 bomber, is actually fairly small. And it's got two wings, obviously, like a plane, but it's also got two engines mounted, an engine on each wing. And the pilot thought he was about to land in Newark when he realized what he saw in front of him was Radio City Music Hall, and he veered off, and instead he hit the 75th floor of the Empire State Building, and the plane went right into the side of the building. The engines, which are very heavy, shot out of their cowlings, you know, just from inertia. They're that heavy. One of them flew all the way across the floor of the Empire State Building and out the opposite wall, landed on the roof of the building next door and caused a fire. The other engine went down an elevator shaft. And in the process of going down 80 floors, it severed all of the cables, all of the safeties, and landed in the sub-basement. And a woman, an elevator operator, who was riding down in one of the elevators, the elevator went into free fall, and she fell about 80 stories. And survived.
Incredible.
And I just an incredible story. So that was in 1945. She died in 1999. She had kids. She got married. She was hospitalized with a broken back, broken legs for about 8 months, but she survived. And they say the rescuers described the floor of the elevator as cracked like an egg. Just that vision of what that must have been like for her. And yet she survived. They say the reason is because when the elevator came down, it was going so fast that the air compressed underneath it and kind of provided some buoyancy for when it hit bottom. And also all those cables coiled up below it cushioned the fall. So that's why, because you would think it would be certain death. So that just fascinated me. And once I learned that, I knew that there had to be a connection between my character, Mina Yetner, and the woman in the elevator. She's not Betty Lou Oliver, who's the woman in the elevator, but she is her friend, and I won't tell you any more about that.
In this book, in There Was an Old Woman, it's a great read. It's hugely entertaining, and yet it also tackles some very real issues around development and issues around age discrimination. I mean, both very different, but I found them very telling. Let's take the first one. What's going on in this community without giving the story away? Why did you take the theme of the encroachment of development on ecosystems? Is that going on in the area?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think what's really happening to a lot of areas is they're reclaiming. You know, there's almost no natural marsh left around New York, though in some areas there never was. But a lot of it has been filled. I mean, when they built the highways, where do you put all that debris? You know, it went into the edge of into the coastline. And gradually some marshes have been reclaimed, and one that is being reclaimed is in this area that I set the book in, the Soundview Lagoons. There are efforts to revive the park nearby, and gradually great blue herons are returning, and the sand snails and the crabs, they're coming back. So that's certainly happening here in Boston too. And I'm a birder, you know, we go bird walking all the time, and I love a marsh and all the richness of life in it. And so I had a natural affinity for writing a setting like that. I think the whole thing about waterfront now is it's going to be interesting to see what happens now with the seas rising, you know, and how important we're realizing that marshes are just as buffers for residential neighborhoods, and some of them, many of them are just gone.
Absolutely. I mean, I know in New York there are hopefully plans afoot to begin to create reefs again. In fact, and there are oyster reefs that are being planned, and some are being developed out in Long Island, on the east end of Long Island that I know of, so that you can even harvest your protection against sea level rise.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
It's a win-win.
It is, and it'll be a lose-lose without it.
Indeed it will, yep.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with mystery writer Hallie Efron about her latest novel, There Was an Old Woman. And then the second issue is the way people see the old, and I found that also very telling. You have a character in the book, Brian. He's the nephew of, he's Mina's nephew, and he's a difficult figure in some ways to figure out until the end. And even then, I wasn't really sure, you know, how much of how he treated Mina was really intentional and how much not, although I think that does get somewhat cleared up. But it's so easy for him to treat her like a cipher, like somebody who doesn't know what she's doing, who is failing, and for him to make decisions for her. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you wrote that into the story?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I find myself doing it. You know, you run into people in the supermarket or in the library, and they're obviously old. And we all draw conclusions about, you know, we talk slowly to them, we talk a little louder, we, you know, just kind of patronizing, actually. And I remember my 91-year-old mother-in-law, who up until the last 2 weeks of her life, was taking the subway from Brooklyn into New York. She would go to something at Lincoln Center and then walk across town to the Donnell Library for something else, and then go back, go into the supermarket, get her dinner, and wheel it home. You know, she was very independent and she had a tremendous stamina. And there was nothing old about her mind. And I remember asking her, I said, you know, do you feel old? How does it feel to be? And she said, you know, I feel like I did at 8 or 18 or 28. She said, I don't feel like a different person. And so when I wrote Mina, I tried to write someone who is not that different from me. She's old. She's got a lot of history. She's seen things. So she has a certain jadedness because she knows how things often turn out. She uses slightly different vocabulary. She talks about the icebox instead of the refrigerator. But she's basically just as sharp as she was, you know, 40 years ago. But she's terrified that she's losing her mind. And I think we all feel that as proper nouns begin to slip. I wake up in the morning and I have to feel my toothbrush to see if I just brushed my teeth. If I just brushed my teeth, I can't even remember. And we do what she does in the opening chapter, which is we look at the obituaries to see who's older than us.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think more and more people are making it into their 80s and 90s. And a lot of them are not well and are, you know, there is Alzheimer's, but there's a lot of them that are perfectly fine, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And God willing, we will be like your aunt as well. I mean, what a...
Yes, and drop dead as she did, which is the way to go.
Yeah, that is the way to go.
Yeah.
Old women, you know, also get a short shrift in most literature, although I think it's a little bit different in mysteries after Miss Marple. But still, I found this, it was a sensitive portrait and not a very common one.
Yeah, and I just was writing a blog for someone on who would I want to star in the movie, if there were a movie. And I went and looked for actresses still working in their 80s, and there aren't very many. But there's a whole load of men in their 80s, you know, still working, which tells you something, too. You know, that we just like to relegate old women in particular to the corner of the attic. Or, you know, where we don't have to look at them, and I think it's a shame. So, yes, I was conscious about it, and I was actually a little worried that a book that had as a main character a woman that old would not be well received. And, you know, it's been the opposite. People really like her. They're interested in her, and that has... It's, I mean, she's not even real, and yet I feel enormously proud of her, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, she is a terrific character, and, you know, as the reading audience ages, which I understand it probably is, you're probably going to get more interest in older characters.
Yeah. I hope so, and older women.
Yeah.
You know, I've been doing something on the side, which is counting the... This is way off the edge, but I'll say it anyway. I've been counting I've noticed that in our local paper, I live in the Boston area, in the Boston Globe, they write feature articles about some people who die. So every day there might be two, there might be four of these feature articles. And I have noticed, if all you looked at was the feature articles, you would think no women are dying. In the last 4 days, there have been 11 obituaries, not one woman.
Oh, my God.
I know. And over time, I've done it over a couple of months, it's 6-1.
Oh,
men.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, so it's really, you know, it's a problem.
That is very interesting. Yeah. Well, Hallie Efron, I'm so glad you wrote this book. I enjoyed it on many levels. The novel is There Was an Old Woman, A Novel of Suspense. Thanks so much for talking with us again here.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been great.
Hallie Efron is the author of numerous works of suspense, including Never Tell a Lie, which we spoke to her about in 2009, and Come and Find Me. She's also co-author of the Dr. Peter Zak Mystery Series and a how-to book, Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel. There Was an Old Woman was published by William Morrow in April 2013. You can read an excerpt from Hallie Efron's There Was an Old Woman by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Lionel Shriver and Big Brother after the break. Stay tuned.
En los pies, mal aliento sale de mi boca, palabras de fetidez. Este pelo pica, barbacita perezosa. Soy una oruga que nunca muda en mariposa. No quiero que me vean, no quiero que me oigan.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Are we our brother's keepers? What happens when the needs of our family of origin, parents and siblings, conflicts with our family of choice, spouse and children? And what if those needs, great as they are, arise out of self-inflicted wounds we had no part in creating? This question lies at the heart of Lionel Shriver's new novel, Big Brother. The brother in question is morbidly obese, topping the scale at more than 300 pounds. Edison is a compulsive overeater whose gigantic girth has caused him to lose his career as a musician and ultimately rendered him penniless and homeless. So he turns to his ever-adoring younger sister Pandora to give him a home. The only trouble is, Pandora already has others in her home, her whippet-thin husband Fletcher and two teenage children. Fletcher is Edison's polar opposite, a healthy eating fanatic who drives his wife and kids crazy with his diet dictates. So when Edison comes for what turns out to be a very extended visit, the stage is set for a drama of divided loyalties. Pandora is desperate to help her brother lose weight, a project she takes on with missionary zeal. But her husband is decidedly not on board. Fletcher wants nothing more than for Edison to leave and go back from whence he came. The choice Pandora ends up making changes all their lives forever. Lionel Shriver is the author of 12 novels, including the prize-winning We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was made into a movie, and So Much for That, a novel that took on the dysfunctionality of the U.S. healthcare system. We spoke with Shriver about that book in 2010.
And so, Lionel Shriver, welcome to Writer's Voice. Welcome back.
Thank you.
In this book, you take up a number of different themes. I mean, it goes deeper than the issue of obesity, but still that does play a pretty prominent role in this novel, Big Brother. Why did you decide you wanted to tackle obesity and weight loss and all that?
Well, obviously, it's a big social issue now, and I'm a sucker for those. I have a history. But I also had a personal motivation. I lost my own older brother to the complications of obesity in 2009. And so that made me feel intimately concerned with the issue and as well a sense of, I guess I'd call it ownership, that the topic belonged to me.
And, that's very sad. Were you involved in trying to get him to lose weight?
No, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. Most siblings are not going to be in that position. So in that sense, the novel is entirely fictional because the sister in the novel does, in fact, sequester herself with her brother in a separate apartment, and they go on a crash diet together. But that was never really a possibility for me.
Right.
I live in London. My brother was living in North Carolina. But there was an interesting moment, which in some ways kicked off the whole novel for me. And I was in London at that time. My brother had gone into hospital. And I was his health proxy. So that meant that when medical decisions needed to be taken, when he couldn't make them himself, and he was sedated at the time, then the doctor consulted me. And at that point, the doctor rang me up and said it looked as if my brother was going to pull through. And so we needed to talk about what was next. I asked whether or not my brother Greg was a likely candidate for bariatric surgery, and the doctor allowed that. In fact, he'd a very good candidate for, say, gastric bypass. But he added the caveat that he would need to have somebody to take care of him, and he would also need somewhere to live in the New York area because this was a New York hospital. My brother had been visiting my parents at the time. And this hospital was renowned for work with obese patients, so it would have been a good choice. Well, I knew my elderly parents couldn't take on my brother, but it did occur to me that my husband and I have a house in Brooklyn, and it has a granny flat in the basement with a separate kitchenette and bathroom. And I really had to wonder whether or not that was the next step, that I should put up my brother and see him through a gastric bypass operation. Well, I never had to answer the question as to whether I was up for that, because 2 days later, he took a sudden turn for the worse and died. So it was that lingering image of my brother living in our house and what that would be like that gave me the inspiration for writing Big Brother.
In this book, and you have some wonderful names here, Pandora, the sister of Edison, she faces some real loyalty conundrums. Her husband wants her to stay at home with him, and she makes a different choice. Set us up. Tell us what's going on here. What are the choices she faces, and why does she make the choice that she ultimately does?
Well, it is a story about conflict of loyalties, and of a sort that I think a lot of us end up encountering at one time or another. You have more than one family once you grow up and get married. So sometimes your loyalty to your old family and your new family come into conflict. I think it's also quite common for spouses to be a little jealous of the kind of intimacy that siblings enjoy. They leave you out. And the brother and sister in the book grew up in a very peculiar family. They grew up in Hollywood, and their father was a character on a television drama in the 1970s. And this knits the brother and sister together even in adulthood. And the husband feels excluded and resentful. And I think that kind of a triangular relationship is pretty commonplace. You have to learn to divide your loyalties. And sometimes you have to choose. And in the book, she has to choose.
And, you know, this all sounds very serious, and it is, but you also have a marvelously satiric pen in this book, Big Brother. I think you paint the husband, Fletcher, as a real character, a character that I'm sure many of the people listening to this show recognize. Tell us about him and you know, I mean, he's not a bad guy by any means, but he can be a little insufferable.
Oh, more than a little insufferable. he's what Pandora calls a nutritional Nazi. And I'm sure we've all met such people. He's a control freak. He doesn't want his two kids eating, you know, foods that are bad for them, cheese and sugar and all that. He's a fanatic cyclist, and his wife simply cannot understand how he can bear the boredom of it, because he's just constantly going out for the same ride along the same route and coming back and keeping track of whether he's done it a few seconds faster. He is hard to live with and drives both his kids and his wife into the arms of the worst diet imaginable just out of rebellion. And I think that happens all the time. It's like all you have to do is say, you know, you may not have a cupcake and all you want is a cupcake. I don't find him a malign character, and I'm sympathetic with his desire to perfect himself, but he makes the mistake of a lot of people like this, that to perfect the body is to perfect the self, and it isn't. In fact, the more he becomes driven to have this perfect nutritional life and have this ideal fitness regime, the more as a person he becomes intolerable.
Yeah. And you also take up for some biting commentary. I think the whole diet industry and the whole way that we relate to food. I mean, it seems in reading your book, Lionel Shriver, and reading Big Brother, I mean, I certainly saw myself. I saw my own struggles. I try to eat right. I try to lose weight. It seems to be a losing battle. You know, talk a little bit about this whole the whole difficult relationship that we have with diet and dieting and food in this country.
Well, I'm a little mystified how our relationship to food grew so complicated. I mean, it used to be that you ate when you were hungry and you quit when you were full. And, you know, you don't find very many people like that anymore, not in Western countries. It's a little distressing. As Pandora puts it, every time she opens the refrigerator, she feels that she's staring into a library of self-help books with air conditioning. And I miss our lost innocence. And I think part of the whole weight problem has become sourced in this over-concern, the fact that we are so disturbed by the idea of being, you know, even 5 pounds overweight, in some ways makes us, by putting food so centrally in our lives, I think it makes us eat more of it.
It certainly makes us think about it all the time.
Yeah, and I think that we have become, in a collective sense, mentally ill, that we're all suffering from an eating disorder of one way or another. I mean, the way Fletcher relates to food in the book is just as neurotic as the way Edison does. They may do different things, but they're still obsessed with food. We somehow have lost a sense of proportionality.
And you also explore the other side of this, too, which is not eating any food. They go on a diet. Is it okay for me to say this?
Yeah, I think that's not too bad of a spoiler.
Okay. Pandora and Edison go on a diet where they don't eat anything.
Well, you know, this is one of the diets out there. They don't use this particular brand, but it's known as the Cambridge diet. And you just drink little envelopes of protein powder. And they give you all the essential enzymes and vitamins. But otherwise, you live on, I think you start out on something really restrictive, like a little over 500 calories a day. And I know somebody in London who's done this more than once, so I had a ready source of information on it. And I've seen the transformation that this friend of mine went through. You lose huge amounts of weight in an amazingly short period of time, so it's quite efficient. But, of course, you can imagine it's also alienating from other people. It removes you socially. There's no going out for a beer or having dinner with people. And it also induces an interesting sense of power and superiority.
Of what?
Power and superiority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same more.
Which can be rather addictive. And in the book, it does become addictive. Pandora ends up losing far more weight than she should.
Yeah, and it's so strange. It's almost as if once the connection to food is cut...
another very strange kind of psychosis takes over, a total disconnection to the body and the body's needs.
Yes, well, you start beginning to believe that you don't really need it, that what you've been told since you were a kid that you needed food to survive is a lie, and in fact, you don't need it. And, well, it's true that we are built to, you know, survive periods of starvation, and that's what that is. It is starving, but there's a limit.
Mm-hmm. And so in some way, without really talking about it, you're really exploring that side. When you say power, control, superiority, that puts me in mind of the reasons why people become anorexic or bulimic.
Absolutely. It's the same psychology. And that's why anorexia tends to draw high achievers, because it creates, you know, when you learn to go without food and you feel better than all these people, as Pandora says, wallowing in buckets of extra crispy. that is alone, that sense of superiority and belonging to an elite is quite addictive and very, very dangerous.
Say more about that.
Well, there's been a little experience in my own family of this, and it really. I find nothing more frightening than anorexia. I do think it's much more frightening than someone who eats too much.
Mm.
And when you do starve yourself like that, you start having mental problems. It makes you unable to think clearly, and that becomes one of the things that perpetuates the condition, is that you can't focus, you can't think intelligently. And for some reason, people get to the point where they can't see themselves correctly, so that they look in the mirror and there are all these ribs showing, and all that person sees is fat. And if you can't believe the truth of your own eyes, you're pretty far gone. And I think that what happens is that anorexics start associating eating with failure, and therefore to eat is to disappoint yourself.
Right.
And it can really spiral. I mean, if I had a child and I could choose between a child that had a problem with being overweight and a child who had a trouble with anorexia, I'd take a fat kid any day.
Wow. And yet in our culture, there's so much revulsion against being fat. I mean, I when reading this novel, your latest novel, Big Brother, I was revolted by the descriptions of Edison. And I had to struggle with that with myself, because I had to keep reminding myself that it's probably much worse to be inside that body than to be reading about it.
Well, one of the things that interests me about the obesity issue is that we talk about it all the time in terms of health. You know, it's not good for you. You're going to get diabetes. You know, you're courting problems with your heart. That's the way we conduct the discourse. But the cultural truth of the matter is quite to the contrary. I think it's still primarily an aesthetic issue, that we have learned to find fat revolting on just as, you know, it's ugly. And that gets confused with, oh, it's unhealthy. So people who are prejudiced against people who are heavy are going to use the language of health and health insurance and, you know, oh, it costs us so much money in an aggregate sense as a country. But the truth of the matter is that they are just viscerally repelled by fat. And the other complication is that we have loaded all this moral baggage on weight, moral and character baggage, so that, you know, fat isn't simply unhealthy. It's evil. It's morally wrong. And furthermore, people who eat too much aren't just indulging in nutritionally dubious practice that isn't good for their own health, but they are betraying a weakness of character. Now, so they're lazy, they're self-indulgent, they're indulging in self-denial. And, you know, this is, especially when it comes to a trait like laziness, is this fair? You know, there are a lot of heavy people that work very hard.
And yet, your character Edison in this book is not exactly a morally upstanding character either. I mean, he's kind of the polar opposite of Pandora's husband, Fletcher. But tell us about Edison, and you painted him with a pretty strong brush as well, although he does mellow out at other points.
Yeah, well, I think he redeems himself toward the end of the book.
Yeah.
But he's a good example of someone who has become grossly overweight, but the reasons for that are quite complicated. And they are intertwined with other problems in his life. His career has hit the skids. His marriage has broken up. He doesn't have any communication with his only son. He has a lot of financial problems and has had to hit his friends up for a place to live. You even find out at a certain point that he's put all of his possessions into storage and then wasn't able to keep up with the rent, and all of his possessions were auctioned off. I mean, there's this whole stack of troubles that he's carrying with him, and that's what helps to explain why he might not only in some ways have given up, but have embraced a kind of self-punishment. And I'm sympathetic with that. I mean, I do think that's one of the things that makes obesity so difficult to solve. I mean, not only is losing weight a big drag, and it takes forever, but you may have gained the weight in the first place for reasons having to do with big issues in your life, other relationships in your life, perhaps other disappointments in your life, and just losing the weight doesn't solve those problems. And I think the complexity of the emotional explanations for why people gained weight in the first place helps also to explain why so many people who, when they do go through the Herculean task of losing sometimes hundreds of pounds, often end up gaining it all back again. And that's because the core problems haven't been addressed.
There's also that's a very painful aspect of the book, and I went along with that, you know, the whole struggle that they both have overweight. I wonder if I could ask you, you had a brother who must have gone through some of this. I mean, did he couldn't have started out as too overweight, right?
No, he was quite a normal weight for most of his life.
Okay. And, I mean, without getting into the particulars, if you don't want to, your own reaction as you saw him gain weight, what were you feeling as you saw him?
Well, I think anybody who has someone in their family who has trouble with obesity will recognize this. I mean, the primary experience is one of helplessness and confusion, like concern. Not only with the weight itself, but also, what does this mean? And in fact, the book is constructed in some ways as a psychological mystery. Your first impulse is like, what has happened to you? What happened? So it's on more than one level. You know, you don't want to see someone imperil their health. You don't want to lose them, but you're also worried on emotional level. You know, are you unhappy? Why are you so unhappy?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Lionel Shriver about her latest novel, Big Brother. The whole other issue, and we talked about it before, is loyalty and divided loyalties. In this one as well, is there some of that experience that you've had? I mean, you say something in this book about family that, you know, you can't really get away from family. You have to. You can't say no, ultimately.
I think you actually can get away from family if you want to. It's a pretty brutal decision. But you can do it. I think where it gets more complicated is when you don't decide that you're going to walk away. I mean, after all, as an adult, you have that option. There's no law that says that you have to keep in touch with your parents and your siblings, much less, you know, take up their problems and try to solve them.
Mm-hmm.
The weird thing is that when you do muck in and you do stay in touch and you do try to help each other, there's no limit. There's no point at which you just have done enough and then you can say, well, I'm going to stop now. I think the simplest example is, say, what if you've got somebody in your family, for argument's sake, a sibling, who's broke, who's chronically broke? Do you give them money? Now, maybe you do. Maybe you do give them some money. But maybe they stay broke and they need more money. At what point do you tell them, no, they can't have any more money, as long as you still have some resources yourself? And that's what I'm talking about. If you just say right up front, no, I'm not going to give you any money. I'm just your sister or brother. I don't owe you a living. Go somewhere else. Then you're off the hook. But as soon as you start acting willing to, you know, okay, fine, here's $500, no problem. You know, I hope that gives you the rent money for this month. And there's always the rent money next month. I mean, that's what's so frustrating is if you're a complete jerk, you can get off really quite lightly. But if you are your brother's keeper, there's potentially no end to it.
And Pandora is her brother's keeper, and she does go to a very, very far space with that. And I think all of us who have family, and most of us do, can recognize that pull, where she's even able to say to her husband, you know, as much as I love you, I have to choose this person who needs me more than you do.
Yeah, and you can see how a husband would take that badly. I mean, I'm actually quite sympathetic with Fletcher on this point.
Absolutely, I was as well. Well, it's a terrific read. I read it in one go. I just really couldn't put it down. Lionel Shriver, your latest novel is Big Brother. You seem to be producing them on a fairly frequent clip these years, so I look forward to the next book as well.
Oh, dear, that means I have to get back to work. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Same here. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lionel Shriver's previous books include the Orange Prize winner, We Need to Talk About Kevin, So Much for That, and The Post-Birthday World. She's also a widely published journalist whose work has been featured in The Guardian, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal, among others. You can read an excerpt from Big Brother by going to writersvoice.net. And tune in next week. We'll be talking about chemical toxins in our environment. First, we speak with journalist Dan Fagan about the cancer cluster that blew the lid off Ciba Geigy's devastation of Toms River, New Jersey. His book is Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And then we speak with filmmaker Ed Brown. Becoming a new father led him to ask what poisons his baby was being exposed to, and to his fascinating documentary, Unacceptable Levels. That's all coming up next week on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.